Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen, a weekly program for teens and families and parents and educators and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield. Trauma is a thief. Trauma robs you. Dr. Neil King, psychologist, professor, former college president, and trauma survivor, has dedicated his life to understanding the developmental and lifelong impact of trauma. Dr. King shares his own struggles toward healing, wholeness, and understanding trauma through lived experience. He experienced various forms of trauma and sexual and physical abuse, abandonment, and family dysfunction. Dr. King, welcome to 411 Teen.
Thank you, Dr. Holyfield. Thanks for the invitation. I appreciate being here.
I'm so glad to have the opportunity to talk to you. So I appreciate you sharing your time and your expertise. What inspired you to write Trauma is a Thief?
To be honest, it got to a point where it felt like it had to be written. As I mentioned in the book, I'm the sole surviving member of my family, which was a very disturbed family. And as I reflected on still being here, still having a life, really a full life, a very blessed to have a good life, I thought an awful lot about the people who were no longer here and what that meant and what their lives have been like. And then I realized I have training. I'm articulate. I can write. I'm a psychologist. I was a researcher. I can try to put into words the experience of not only being born into and living through, but surviving that family, and try to do justice to the experience of the folks who aren't here anymore. And in the process, my hope is to try to create a work that can be meaningful for people who are themselves trauma survivors and struggling with trauma, for family members who are trying to understand what they experienced, and for people who treat and study trauma survivors. So it's a bit of a complex web of why and how I wrote it, but that's about as succinct as I can be at the moment.
Well, I applaud you for a job well done. I think you met all your goals. I read your book and I found it to be very powerful. And that's why I wanted to have you talk. So I appreciate it. For the listening audience, would you define trauma, or as we call them, ACEs, adverse childhood experiences?
It's a tough one to define because I think it's a beast with many face and tentacles. In my instance, my father was a pedophile and a sociopath and a very angry man and an alcoholic, physically abusive. So my early trauma happened primarily within the family. That isn't always the case. Trauma essentially is really a fundamental insult to the integrity of our humanness, of our sanctity as human beings. In today's world, people are sharing tremendously awful trauma in Gaza, in Ukraine, on the Russian side as well. So it's really difficult to define trauma. I think for young people today, navigating a very complicated environment where social media is so powerful can subject people to a kind of trauma that the young people I worked with in my years as a high school teacher and high school counselor were of a prior generation and didn't have to deal with. But if there's a word I would choose to define trauma, it would be insult, profound insult to the integrity of who we are as people.
When you were writing your book, who was it written for? I mean, did you have a target audience that you were focusing on at all?
my hope was and still is that it speaks to fellow trauma survivors. I learned a lot in writing it. I learned a lot about what had happened to me, what had happened within the family, how I survived, and how it not just influenced, but really determined my early adult life and well into my middle adult life. So I wind up, as I started, hoping that the book is relevant for people who experience trauma themselves, but again, for their loved ones, for people who study. I mean, I'm a psychologist. I had a psychotherapy practice for 14 years. I worked with a number of trauma survivors. I could have used a book like this. It would have helped me understand several of the people I worked with at a deeper level.
What do you hope, and I think you sort of alluded to this, that your readers will take away from this book?
One fundamental thing is you're not alone, which is one of the things that I realized in my own recovery process, is that particularly when you're isolated in a family and that's where the trauma occurs, that's just a part of your life. And it doesn't occur to you that A, anybody could help you, and B, anybody could understand you, and maybe C, that there are other people experiencing what you're experiencing. And so part of the impact of that is you develop a profound sense of shame because this is happening to you, because you couldn't stop it, because you know, you weren't stronger, you weren't better. And when you realize you're not alone, it's an important first step in throwing off the shame, which I think is, an important first step in recovery. As you said in the intro, and I believe, you never recover 100% from significant trauma, but you can recover a big percent, and it's throwing off the shame is a big step in making that happen.
Let's look at the developmental effects of trauma on children and adults. Exactly how does trauma affect a person's development at a young age, at childhood? And I think it's different childhood through adulthood, but if you would share your take, your perspective on it, I'd love to hear.
Sure. Yeah. No, I think you're right. I agree with you at any rate that it is different. If someone's first experience of trauma is as an adult, you have a secure base from which to react to the trauma. As a child, you have what you have. And again, in the instance of my siblings and myself, our earliest trauma was we were abandoned by my father was overseas in the military. My mother abandoned us, was reportedly having an affair. I have no way of validating that. And my brother may have been 7 or 8. I was 3 or 4. My sister was barely an infant. Were surrendered to the authorities. Mm-hmm. And my father was brought back from overseas to come and get us and find my mother. So the effect of that is, you know, you don't have the cognitive ability to understand what's happening to you, but you understand emotionally that your whole protective environment has been shattered, and that the people responsible for it have betrayed you. They left you. And so from that point forward, trusting other people to have your best interests at heart really is a major life task. And it certainly was one of mine. When you have that initial trauma compounded by physical abuse, sexual abuse, each one of those, they interact with each other, and each one of those has its own negative effects on you as you develop. And so it's not at all uncommon for people who experience significant trauma to become depressed, to become withdrawn. If some of the trauma is sexual, as I mentioned in the book, you go to one extreme or the other. You tend to go to one extreme or the other. You become hypersexual. The world is very sexual and you are very sexual. Or hyposexual, you withdraw and you withdraw into yourself. And so any normal developmental psychosexual development is not available to you because the path has been changed, fundamentally changed by the trauma.
And looking at trauma, talking about trauma, particularly when you're talking about it, you find that there are some common misconceptions about the impact of trauma. Have you experienced that? And if so, can you share some of those common misconceptions that exist?
Yeah, some of the things that come to mind are, for the person looking at someone who's experienced trauma, is that somehow you're responsible for that you let that happen, that, you know, if you had been stronger or smarter, that wouldn't have happened to you. Another, I think, is that, oh, it's no big deal. And I think the trauma survivor is susceptible to a lot of denial and doesn't realize why she or he becomes depressed or drinks heavily or is more inclined to overindulge in the area of recreational drugs or harder drugs than their contemporaries. There's something internally driving them, but they don't really fully understand what it is. And putting the finger on trauma as being a major factor there is often elusive. And at its extremes, trauma kills. Mm-hmm. Trauma is directly responsible for many deaths through addiction, through violence, actively and passively. My older brother drank himself to death. I think of that as a kind of suicide. He was only 47 years old. He was otherwise a healthy guy. So would people looking at his life say that happened because of his early life? I think a lot of people would not.
I don't think they would either. Mm-mm. No. You know, as you talk about trauma, we know that there is a clear relationship between trauma and mental health issues, and I think you kind of alluded to them. The depression and anxiety and PTSD, and often, particularly when you are young, they are the individual who is experiencing these, the young child or the school child, is mischaracterized. We're going to take a brief break, but I'd like to come back and talk about that if you are willing. So we're going to hold and take a brief break right now. Today's program delves into the psychological, emotional, and social pathways toward healing and resilience connected to experiencing trauma. I'm talking with Dr. Neil King, author of Trauma is a Thief. Dr. King, before we went on break, we were just talking about, I was sharing with you just how trauma is mischaracterized often in children. When you see mental health issues like anxiety and depression and PTSD, that they're not just bad kids or they're not hyperactive. And wanted to have you address some of that.
Yeah. So I mentioned in the book, my early career before I went back to graduate school in my 30s and finished a doctorate and became a psychologist was working as a high school teacher and counselor, and I also worked in residential treatment for kids who were labeled emotionally disturbed, and they tended to be early to late teens. Mm-hmm. And I wish I could go back knowing what I know now and work with those kids, because I think I would have been a lot better in all of those contexts. So kids who were withdrawn, who were nasty, sometimes who were petty thieves, sometimes who were, prone to some kinds of destructive violence, who were not very nice to other kids. I don't think I ever kind of took that as being a reality unto itself, but I understand at a greater depth now. And I used to talk about this with my graduate students when I was teaching child development and child psychopathology. is that you can't just identify a symptom and say, I understand the person. You have to look at, and the phrase I would use is, what is the meaning of this behavior? So in a residential treatment setting, a 13-year-old, one time it wasn't my shift, but broke a window and put the jagged end over the head of the counselor who was on duty and threatened to slice his throat. That's a pretty dramatic thing to do. So to use my later acquired understood question, what's the meaning of this behavior? Well, he felt threatened. He felt triggered. He had been removed from his family and placed in residential treatment. Often even a heavily traumatized kid would not have chosen to be removed from their family. Mm-hmm. They would rather be with a familiar than be in a situation like that. As a high school counselor, kids who I would experience as being withdrawn, socially awkward, unusually shy, sad a lot of the time. I always knew that I could compare them with their happier, more well-adjusted, more outgoing peers. But I think I would have acquired a sense that I would have spent more time trying to understand the meaning of their behavior and the context. So when I was working at the American School in London, I had the opportunity often to visit students' families. And it opened up avenues of understanding that I couldn't have had interacting just with the child. And I often came to understand the behavior better by being able to understand the context.
How did your abuse, the abuse you experienced, shape your mental health as you grew older?
Yeah, I talk about that in the book, and mm-hmm. I try to say that my path is not everybody's path, but right. But from early on, I just felt like I was going to fight. I was going to fight my father. I was going to fight whatever felt to me like it was suffocating and trying to deprive me. And so I sought out good people. I learned to escape. Escape was a primary survival mechanism for me, physically escape internally. I mentioned, there's a section of the book too, where I mentioned that by the time that I retired, and it wasn't until then, I realized how profoundly tired I was from all of the striving, from all of the struggling, from all of the hypervigilance. And so I developed a mask. I was a popular guy, a good student. I was elected student body president in high school and college. And I found a way to separate my internal reality from what people experienced through the mask. But internally, I was sad. I was frightened. I was very socially awkward. I had no idea how to successfully establish relationships. A lot of my shame was acted out in my secret life, mm-hmm. where I would frequent male escorts. And relate to them. I mean, I got them, they got me. We had all been beaten up in our early lives in certain ways. They were my dalliances with them were inconsistent with the life I lived on the other side of my mask. And all of those, and I think this is true for any trauma survivor, all of those effects are happening simultaneously, and you don't have any perspective on them. They are just a lot of what churns on your insides. So it's hard to get a grip on them. And the many therapies that I described, some formal, some informal, really were the things that saved my life, literally saved my mm-hmm. life, but helped me out of that morass.
When did you first realize that you had experienced abuse?
It took me a while to sort of think of it in those terms. I mentioned after my father having successfully sexually abused me when I was 12 on one of his ships, there was a time when we were alone in the house and he was chasing me around with an obvious erection, trying to catch me. And it was clear what his intent was. And I was as clear that wasn't going to happen. And I managed to get outside, and I stayed outside until I saw somebody else come home. Did I think of that as having been abused? I don't think that was the concept, but more, it was a very strong realization that this is not right and this shouldn't be happening. And I'm not going to let it happen. And I don't care who he is. I don't care if he is my father. So I think those were the beginnings of the realization. I think it wasn't until terminology began to emerge in the larger culture about childhood sexual abuse and dysfunctional families. And certainly then, you know, I was swimming in that terminology when I was studying to be a psychologist, that a lot of, you know, light bulbs would go, aha, oh, that's what that was. I didn't know that. Oh, yeah. So getting to the point where those concepts, which were very, very helpful and continue to be very helpful, were present for me, it took a while.
Mm-hmm. Childhood trauma, like yours, often, I would say, rewires the brain, or it influences your relationships, and it influences your decision-making. Do you agree with that, disagree? And would you just talk about how childhood trauma impacted you in that way?
Yeah, I think it, thinking about the word rewire, I think it kind of takes over the wiring in a certain way. Like whatever amount of wiring that would have led to a normal trajectory has taken place, trauma interrupts it. And it sends it off in different directions. So I absolutely agree that it does do that. And I would often say to my adult psychotherapy clients who had suffered significant trauma that a thing that would really help us make progress in our work was the realization that as adults, they're big and strong, they have cognitive capacities, they have social networks, all kinds of resources they didn't have as a child. And they can, in order to move in a healthier direction and become a more integrated and whole and human being and have a rich life, they needed to lessen their grip on protecting themselves from their childhood trauma because they weren't as vulnerable as they had been. And that was a revelation to a lot of people, and it wasn't easy. That meant beginning to trust. That meant beginning to consider that there were other possibilities of a full life than what they had been living. So I think there some of the corrective wiring can begin to take place. But you've read the book, so you know that my own belief is that you can never completely erase what happened and replace it with what should have happened. But I think it's a very invasive energy and dynamic, and it's very, very difficult to disentangle.
Well, what strategies have you found to be, I guess, most effective for healing trauma? What worked best for you?
Yeah, I think it's for me, it's a bit of a mix when I talk about it. Escape, travel, meditation. I think trauma has left me a person who doesn't consider himself religious, but who does consider himself deeply spiritual. And I think an appreciation of the spiritual has been a great comfort for me. Silence. I've come to really love silence. My discernment, I think this has really helped me in my adult life, and both as a psychotherapist and as a professor and administrator, all of that. I can sniff a narcissist from a mile away. My antenna go up around people who are dangerous. So collectively, the strategies that worked for me were various therapies, dogs. I love dogs. Mm. Dogs were like spirit guides to me. The world of the spirit, meditation, the various psychotherapies that I engaged in, mm-hmm. hypnotherapy. So it's really quite a mix.
Yeah, it
but
was.
I also want to say that a lot of people find therapies that weren't part of my therapies. Artists can find you know their artistic expression can be enormously therapeutic and enormously healing. So it's a great question. It's a difficult one to answer because I think it's very individual.
Do you feel the family dynamics influence the healing process for trauma survivors? I mean, and how do they, or how do they influence the healing process at all?
I think they absolutely do, both negatively and positively. Where you have trustworthy, loving members of the family, those are enormously powerful resources. Mm-hmm. If you also have these harmful presences in the family. In my experience, I feel like I carried the weight of my really disturbed family through most of my adult life, feeling somehow responsible for it. I have said to several people, this has surprised me. It wasn't until my younger sister died seven and a half years ago that I felt like I could even sort of conceive of the story that I've written in the book. So it took perspective because I was always her big brother and I always wanted to make her safe. And I've always felt helpless when there were forces that I couldn't control that were not positive forces in her life. And so I think I have cousins who have said, I have divorced myself from my early life and from my mm-hmm. family life. And I get what they're saying. I'm not sure I fully believe them because in my world, in my mind, excuse me, I don't know that I think that's fully possible.
You mentioned shame. Do you feel that survivors overcome the shame and the stigma that is often associated with abuse? And I know it depends on the individual and it's different strokes, but different strokes for different folks. But I mean, I guess because I'm coming from the position where I don't think that happens, but that I want to hear from somebody else. Okay. And I want to hear what you think. Do survivors really overcome the shame and the stigma?
Again, I would say like the trauma itself, not 100%.
Okay.
But I think, and I think I've made enormous efforts. And I think for me, a lot, this book was really powerful in that direction. And part of it was telling the secrets. And part of it was just mm-hmm. saying out loud all this crap that I've been carrying around mm-hmm. and feeling responsible for and sharing it with other people. I can honestly say I feel that I live with less shame, less depression than I ever have in my life. And now, you know, I'm now in my late 70s. It's taken a while to get there. Mm-hmm. But I do think that, you know, community, finding good people who you can trust. And there's some courage involved, you know, deciding to basically do battle with the demons, that those help you lessen. I don't think you can ever take it away, but they help you lessen the power of the shame.
Do you feel like individuals, or individual support even from loved ones, that they're dealing with the trauma can be therapeutic?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. Okay. One of the most powerful. Okay. I mentioned my partner, Peter, we've been together almost 30 years. Mm-hmm. The mere fact of our relationship and his presence in my life has been enormously healing. And when we met, I had reached a point where I thought I was just too damaged to have any kind of a deep relationship and a genuine relationship. And I just sort of worked at accepting that because I thought, well, it wouldn't have been my choice, but I didn't create my early life. I lived it. But evidently, with work and with time, you know, is able to enter into that relationship. Now, you know, within a family, my sister and I were very close. So she and I were enormously supportive of and helpful toward. Unfortunately, she suffered from the family curse of addiction, and it robbed her of herself, and those others of us who loved her, it robbed our lives of her. But yes, absolutely, to your question, I think that supportive family members are a godsend.
What, and we haven't talked about this at all, what about the role of the school? Do you feel like the schools are in tune and in touch with what's, and I don't mean specialty schools. I mean, I don't mean a school where someone is going because they're attending this school because they are having problems. I'm just talking about the general public education. Because it seems like kids are going through multiple changes, and they might be picked up by the school. And I'm just wondering, do you see the schools as a change agent? Do you see them as being able to really play a role, maybe even early identification? Because I think that something is going on. I guess I'm even asking as I speak to you, should teacher education be changed? Should we look at that? But we're going to take a break so that they can be in tune and in touch with what's going on psychologically. We're going to take a break and we'll come back to this. You're tuned in to 411 Teen.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
Just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen, and I am talking with Dr. Neil King, author and professor and psychologist, and he wrote Trauma is a Thief, and we've been talking about trauma and the impact. Dr. King, I was asking you about the role of schools, and I'm not asking it as to condemn the schools and saying, oh, they're not doing their job, but I do wonder, do you think the schools, is there anything that we can do in schools? Because there are a lot of kids that experience trauma, and we don't know anything about it.
Yeah, I think, I would say that there was very little education or awareness in the schools that I attended, and yet school was a sanctuary for me. It was a safe place, partly because of I've been, you know, intellectually inclined. It was a stimulating place. I was lucky not to have been abused within the school system. Mm-hmm. In some ways, I never left school. It became my profession. But at the same time, I think about, as you were asking the question, I thought about a student that I had, and a graduate student who had two or three young kids in a child development class. And she said at one point, every person should be required to take this course before they have children. And I said, yeah, in an ideal world, that would be really helpful. Yeah. I don't think, and I was a counselor for years, and I don't remember it being a part of my counselor education. So I think that, and I think in the current climate, which I don't think is very pro-education or pro-social sciences, this is not a top priority, but I think there's an awful lot of room to, even with minor effort, to make teachers, coaches, counselors more aware and more able, I think, to address the needs of their students. However, even in an imperfect system, so many people will look back and that they had a music teacher, they had a coach, they had a counselor, they had an English teacher, mm-hmm. they had some adult who connected with them. And I think that can be a lifeline. It can be life-saving. But to your fundamental question, the schools can play an enormous role. And there's a lot more potential for developing mm-hmm. that capacity than I, in my mind, than we have invested in.
At what point in these last few minutes that we have, I want to look a little bit more at therapy and counseling. At what point for parents who may be listening and educators and whomever, is therapy recommended? When do you feel a child, a teen, should be referred? At what point? What if parents are wondering if their child is going through a number of changes? What point would you say you need to have outside professional intervention?
That's a great question. I think about a person who came to mind as you were saying that was a sophomore, 15, 16 year old, learning disabled, and very stigmatized about his inability to. You know, his mind didn't work the way that a lot of other students did, and he couldn't study as well, he couldn't write as well. Mm-hmm. And he felt so stigmatized by that and so shamed by that, that I talked with his parents, and we all felt that referring him to some external expertise, though it might have been the most helpful thing to him, would also have been sort of damaging to his self-esteem. And so I took on a tutorial relationship with him, even though that wasn't my expertise, but I tried to minimize the meaning of getting help. So I would say that it's a balancing question. When, you know, when behaviors change dramatically, when young people become severely depressed, there's evidence of suicidal ideation, they become hurtful, injurious to other people around them, friends and family. There are behaviors. Again, what's the meaning of this behavior? Uh-huh. They're stealing. They're uh-huh. They're drunk. They're stoned. They're outside of what you would think of as a normal range of even adolescent experimentation. Uh-huh. I would see those behaviors as a call for help. And I think that hopefully teachers can help, but certainly the family needs to be tuned enough in with their children to realize when the line has been crossed between boys will be boys, girls will be girls, and this is outside of that. Mm-hmm. And this probably needs some help. And my experience is that gently, lovingly, as discreetly as possible, when that help is offered, and the connection is real, that's an important piece too, is the chemistry has to be right. Then the child is really very, very grateful for when the connection is made. So it's a delicate task for, mm-hmm. For a parent to make that determination and then really lovingly shepherd the child through the process of connecting with an outside, therapist, helper, counselor who can really be helpful to them.
And that leads right into my next question. Are there keys or clues that parents, you could share with parents in the selection of a therapist or a counselor? Because everyone is not, even if they're a psychologist, is not trained in trauma.
Right, absolutely.
And that's really a key that's very important. Are there things that you could tell parents or even educators who may be listening that may help them to forge ahead and get the correct chemistry and knowledge and training of a therapist? I don't know. I'm just, as we're talking, I'm just thinking about
things. It's an important question. And what comes to mind, first of all, is if you're fortunate enough to have a referral from somebody who's had a good experience, that's mm-hmm. worth its weight in gold.
Yeah.
Because then you have a testimonial that this person was good with this child or with children in general. If you can enlist your son or daughter in the process, who could help you? What are the qualities that you would like? Help me help you. Help. Let's mm-hmm. figure this out together. That would be, I think, very valuable. And absent a direct referral of, you know, I know this person was, the child or the family was helped by, who was that person? How can I get in touch with them? Going to a trusted external professional and seeing it as a, you know, a not a light or a quick process, but a deliberative process, because it's you're interviewing potentially people who will have a big impact on your child and your family, is being willing to invest the time and the energy to do that. Of course, that can be luxurious if resources are an issue. That can be luxurious in more rural communities where there are fewer resources. But I think also it's a matter of trusting your instincts and on some level, trusting the child, because I think there's a lot of wisdom in every child I ever worked with, who knows things about themselves and about what works for them that we can all learn from and that can help us help them.
Well, we've been talking about your book. Where can one purchase, access your book, Trauma is a Thief?
Certainly Amazon is a ready source. It looks like other online booksellers also carry it, but it's not hard to find on Amazon. If you enter my name and the title, it comes up right away, and it's available paperback and hardback. So,
okay. I don't know if you will share your contact information. I mean, do you have a blog? Do you have a website? If folks want to follow you and find out what's happening, do you have that? Or where are you with that? I know you did have one, right?
Well, I did have a website. It's been a while. I kind of let it go away after I retired.
Okay. Yeah,
people are welcome to email me, which is nkingphd@gmail.com. And I'm serious. If you feel so moved and you want to shoot me an email, I would be happy to receive it and respond to you. You know, you can find me on LinkedIn.
Okay.
Neil King, PhD. I'm not hard to find. Those would be the two main things I would suggest. I am no longer practicing psychotherapy, mm-hmm. But I am, I have a small practice now, a consulting practice, where my focus is life transitions for individuals and families and organizations. And sometimes, as I mentioned in my book, a former student or a former client will get in touch and want to have a consultation about what's happening in their life today. So, you know, I would be available both informally and formally in that way, but I just want to be, you know, very clear. I'm no longer doing psychotherapy. So.
Well, what maybe resources or initiatives do you recommend in addition to your book, Trauma is a Thief, but would you recommend for those who may be currently dealing with abuse or its aftermath? Are there any, you know, journals, any resources that you would recommend to the listening audience?
Of course, the internet's powerful. So,
yes.
You know, Googling and making it as focused a search as you can and finding out, depending whether you want something to read, whether you want a group you can join, whether you want, you know, to be able to connect up anonymously with others. I think the way that you define your search can help you locate all of those. But in a general way, I would say, especially if you feel really alone with what you're experiencing, try to identify, a caring, good person in your world who you can talk with confidentially, even just to broach the subject, and enlist them to become, you know, your co-conspirator, the conspiracy being to find your way out, you know, the shame and the enduring effects, and see if you can get a teammate, or maybe, you know, even build a team of 2-3 people who, you know, can be your support in the mm-hmm. process. Those would be the things that come to mind. And again, people's circumstances are so different that it's hard to generalize, but, and follow your instincts. I mean, there's going to be, like I said, you know, from early on, I was clear I was going to fight. And, you know, maybe that's where you start is, you know, mm-hmm. I'm going to fight this. I'm not mm-hmm. going to put up with this. And then see where that takes you.
How do you find meaning or purpose after experiencing such profound trauma? I mean, What does healing look like for you today?
Well, it's a work in progress. Mm-hmm. And what I notice is a shift, as I mentioned toward the end of the book, that whereas trauma used to be this all-consuming roar that controlled my life, it didn't go away, but it's now more of a whisper. Mm-hmm. And what's happened in the interim, and I don't mean to minimize it because it was a lot of time and a lot of work, but is that I let in beauty, friendship, mm-hmm. joy. I found the things that I and the people with whom I could laugh. Laughter is such a great medicine. And if you know I've lost a number of friends, but some of them are people with whom I would laugh more heartily and more often than anybody I've ever known. That's fantastic therapy. Writing. It depends what some people write in journals. I think that can be very helpful. Some people write books, like I do. Maybe that'll be helpful. Some people dedicate themselves to their music. I think all of these things can be powerful avenues. I would say invest in your friendships invest in your human relationships. If you're fortunate enough to be entrusted with a dog, love that puppy and accept their love, and that will be very healing in itself.
Yes, because they have unconditional love. So they're,
exactly.
Yes, it's important. And talking with you, I keep thinking of more and more questions that I'd like to ask, but let me ask this one, at least you can tap into it. What are the signs of intergenerational trauma, and how can families begin to heal collectively? What would be your response to that? In 2 minutes, but in talking to you, it came up, and I thought I need to ask him how he feels about that.
it's another way. I mean, you ask really good questions, and that's a huge one because, you're talking about generations of defenses and denial, mm-hmm. and coping mechanisms, but I guess I feel like it starts with one person, mm-hmm. like my sister and I broke through together in a lot of ways. And, we helped each other. We reinforced one another. I don't know that my brother ever did. My mother died at 53, very depressed, alcoholic. I don't know that she ever did. But to go back, I had some conversations with an uncle. I never had any conversations, mm-hmm. on this topic with any of my grandparents. I knew all of them. And I've learned through my genealogical research and my family history research that, as I talk about, there are generations of trauma, and alcohol, mm-hmm. and addiction, alcoholism, physical violence. In an ideal world, you would be able to gather as many who are willing in a room, in a circle with a facilitator, with a therapist who's up to the task, and begin with identifying and putting words, mm-hmm. to. But it's a huge undertaking, the family would only benefit. But I think it's like I said, it's a big question, and it really would be a really big task.
How the conversation, as we've talked, it generates more and more questions for me to pose to you. I thought about it. And I said, wow, let me see where he sits on that. What does he think? I had to kind of chuckle to myself because I knew you weren't, we could make a whole program on that alone.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, easily. More than one. Yeah.
But last thing, closing words of wisdom, as a psychologist and a survivor, what advice would you offer to others who are on their healing journey? And I know you're probably not going to, I know that's another long thing, and you got 20 seconds for real.
Don't give up. You're worth fighting for. Fight for yourself. You deserve a full life. Go get it.
Okay. Do you have any suggestions where they get that attitude from? it's good.
It's got to come partly from inside, but it's got to also be reinforced by who you hang out with, who you mm-hmm. who you mm-hmm. seek to be with, mm-hmm. even if it's virtually, you know, mm-hmm. who you follow online, who you listen to, whose podcasts you tune into. There are lots of different virtual ways right. to do that. It doesn't have to be the person next door or in your own house.
Well, I appreciate you, and it's time out for this edition of 411 Teen. Special thanks to Dr. Neil King for your candor and sharing your experience. To my listening audience, much appreciation for the privilege of your time and ear. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield, inviting you to tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Teen. 411 Teen was produced by Dr. Liz Holyfield. Technical assistance was provided by Evan Rossi. If you would like to participate in the 411 team or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. You can listen to previous episodes of 411 team at wfsu.org.